of Rio Salado College. For more information, visit sunsounds.org.
And it is now 6 o'clock, time for the reading of the USA Today newspaper, which was provided by the Hampton Inn and Suites today. And so here are your readers tonight, Mike Miller and Bonnie Cohn.
Good evening. This is volunteer broadcaster Mike Miller.
And this is volunteer broadcaster Bonnie Cohn.
And we'll start out with a cover story of the USA Today. And it's by Chris Quintana, and it's entitled Ranking United States Universities, Worthless or Worthwhile. College rankings purport to tell the public which schools are worthwhile, even though many academics view the rankings as worthless. The latest salvo in the battle between the ranked and the rankers came out of Reed College in Portland, Oregon. A statistics professor and a group of students say based on a statistical analysis, Reed College appears to be underranked compared to other schools in the United States. News and World reports ranking of best colleges. The publication denies that claim and questions the accuracy of the group's work. Though the two parties may not come to an agreement, the debate speaks to a broader conversation about the value of quantifying the college experience. Mainly, is there any? In America, the U.S. News and World Report rankings are regarded as the gold standard. The publication's methodology usually changes annually, but it includes student retention and graduation rates, resources available to faculty, and the opinions of fellow college leaders and high school counselors. It also creates snapshots of colleges that include cost, application deadlines, and a school's history. Taken together, the rankings and profiles combined with college visits, interviews, and your own intuition can be a powerful tool in your quest for the right college, the company's website reads. Americans' obsession with choosing the best product also informs the longevity of the U.S. News College rankings, which began in 1983. They persist because choosing where to start a higher education career is confusing, and there are hundreds of colleges, each promising a quality education, but when students cannot figure out who is telling them the truth, a list of winners and losers can seem like a clarion through the noise. Reed College, 38th or 90th? As a statistician, Professor Kelly McCornville is well aware of the value of numbers, but she too has questions about U.S. News ranking system. So McCornville and students Bailey Kruger, Weying Kui, and Wexen Du set about creating a model to test it following a suggestion by the college's Institutional Research Office. Using federally available government data from the Integrated Postsecondary Education Data System and their model, they said they were able to recreate the U.S. News ranking with 94% accuracy. In their model, Reed ranks 38th for liberal arts colleges nationally, but U.S. News model put the college at 90th. McConville said there is variability in the accuracy of the predictions, but it does provide evidence Reed is underranked. We were really surprised, she said. It seems like their models implied that Reed should be ranked higher. The point, McConville said, wasn't to fight over which equation was best, but to show the limitations of the one-size-fits-all model and to demystify the process of ranking. Robert Morse, chief data strategist at U.S. News, challenged the Reed College findings on two grounds. First, he argued it was not possible to reverse engineer the college rankings based only on IPED's data. Secondly, Morse said the publication does not penalize schools that are not participate in the surveys. He added that the magazine relies on IPEDS data when colleges decline to complete the survey. Christopher Mariscano, a professor at Davidson College who studies higher education, said it appears the students were able to predict the U.S. News rankings with a high degree of accuracy, but he cautioned it would be impossible to replicate the scores exactly without the publication's precise formula. He could not perfectly replicate the students' work, but Marasconi looked at publicly available data for colleges and U.S. News rankings in the high 30s and low 90s. He said Reed appeared to share many traits with the high 30s group, including graduation and retention rates, money spent on students, and SAT scores. He did say it's possible that Reed, however, got a bump for having a higher graduation rate than what U.S. News had predicted. Its prediction, Mariscano said, was 5 points below Reed's lowest graduation rate in nearly the past decade. It seems that U.S. News just does not have a good handle on Reed in general. And to be fair, Reed does not send in the survey. So how could U.S. News adequately have a handle on Reed, he asked. A few schools opt out. Rancor over the rankings has long been brewing. Douglas Bennett is one of those longtime critics of the rankings. While president of Earlham College in Indiana, he did not participate in the system, and in 2007 he signed a letter encouraging other leaders in higher education to do the same. Little has changed, he said, since his 2011 retirement. Among his complaints, Bennett said, the rankings measure many factors that do not necessarily reveal how adept a college is at educating students in particular. A portion of the rankings ask presidents to assess their institutions. His response, when he was a president, he could not really know. Nobody should fill these forms out. They do not keep what's going on. They just react to prestige, and prestige is the illusion of quality. It may get at something, but it isn't getting at something real or trustworthy, he said. A small contingent, including Reed, opted out of the on ideological grounds, but the rankings clearly mean something to many others. Some list their rankings on their website as an advertising tool. Others make it part of the institution's goal to rise in the rankings, and in extreme cases, may tie the presidential bonus to moving up, according to Robert Kelchin's Higher Education Accountability. Others lie to boost their standings. In 2019, the University of Oklahoma submitted false data about its fundraising. And in 2018, Temple University's Master of Business Administration program was stripped of its ranking after it was found to have lied about the students' test data, among other things. UC Berkeley, which often ranked as the best public school in the nation, was also recently moved to unranked status after misreporting alumni giving rates. In that case, the university reported the error itself. Numbers without context. Walter Kimbrough, president of Dillard University in New Orleans, has long refused to participate in the ranking system. He joked that he sends the U.S. News and World Report surveys back in the mail labeled as junk. Since the 80s, we have been a brand name nation, and it applies to higher education, Kimbrough said. They are looking for a brand to give themselves some kind of status, he said. Rankings, though, reflect not what colleges do, but who the colleges serve, Kimbrough said. The colleges that do especially well in the rankings are generally the ones with the fewest students on Pell Grants, a type of financial aid given only to students from low-income backgrounds. Students from high backgrounds often have less academic participation and will have more ground to cover. And numbers sans context, he said, mean little. His university's six-year graduation rate in 2012 was 28%, he said. That was true, but it was based on the cohort who started 7 weeks before Katrina. The institution had to shut down for a semester, and they operated partially out of a hotel the next. Some people just never came back, Kimbrough said. For the next 3 years, that was part of the data that informed the U.S. News and World Report ranking. They just see the numbers without a full interpretation of about what those numbers mean, Kimbrough said. And that was an article by Chris Quintana, Analysis Rekindles Debate Over Quantifying Colleges.
Here's an article by Trevor Hughes and Chris Woodyard. Anger greets president in Dayton and El Paso. El Paso, Texas. What would normally be a routine mission to console victims of tragedy became mired in politics and division Wednesday as President Donald Trump touched down in the two cities reeling from mass shootings, Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas. In both cities, Trump was met by a barrage of protesters, many toting signs demanding action to stop gun violence. Trump largely avoided them by going by motorcade straight to private meetings with survivors of the twin massacres. But on Air Force One, between the visits, he unleashed a tweet barrage saying Democrats had mischaracterized his visits with victims, families, first responders, and medical staff. He referred to televised remarks by Senator Sherrod Brown and Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley as totally misrepresenting what took place inside the hospital in Dayton, where Trump held the meeting, which was not open to the media. He did not specify what was said in the remarks. Brown later issued a statement in response. I've said before, Donald Trump is a bully and bullies are cowards. I don't care what he says about me, but the people of Dayton deserve a president more focused on protecting them from gun violence than protecting his own ego. The visits came in reaction to the attack Saturday morning at an El Paso Walmart that killed 22 and injured many others by a suspect possibly motivated by white supremacist views. Then another unrelated attack early Sunday by a gunman wielding an assault rifle left 9 dead and more than 24 injured in an entertainment district in Dayton. The attacks came as Trump has been criticized recently for tweets and comments that detractors have seen as racially divisive. In El Paso, attendees said they are furious that Trump's words have whipped up such hatred. Many wore shirts saying that neither racism nor Trump were welcome in El Paso. Swallowing her newfound fear of being in a crowd, Maricela Hernandez, 23, brought her six-year-old son, Phaeton, who held a homemade sign calling for policy and change instead of thoughts and prayers. I feel like I have to be here now. I can't be a hypocrite and say I want change if I don't show up for change, said Hernandez, a stay-at-home mom. If you don't go out and make change and put in work, do you really want change? I never used to come to these things. But once it hit home, it put things into perspective. In El Paso, the tone of a planned protest rally was set by the area's member of Congress, Representative Veronica Escobar, Democrat, Texas, who refused to meet with Trump until he called her first to discuss the tragedy. The White House declined. Mayor DeMargo, a Republican, said he would show up for the Trump visit to honor the office of president, not the current occupant. A baby Trump balloon and a group of sign-waving demonstrators greeted Trump in Dayton. Protesters said it only 24 hours for two organizers to raise more than $3,000 to bring the tethered protest symbol to the city's Miami Valley Hospital. On it was posted a banner saying, "Stop being a baby, stand up to the NRA." Protesters carried placards that included, "Do something, just say no to fascism, and protect kids, not guns." This article, entitled "Anger Greets President in Dayton and El Paso," was by Trevor Hughes and Chris Woodyard.
And the Sun Sounds of Arizona time is 6:17. Our next article is by Marie Backman and is entitled, "It's Smart to Allow Personal Tasks at Work." As an employer, it's natural to want to get the most out of your employees during the workday. The more productive they are, the more your business benefits. In fact, when you are on the management side, you may not take kindly to catching your employees engaging in personal tasks during the day, whether it's scheduling appointments, answering emails from friends, or confirming weekend plans. But actually doing personal tasks during the workday is pretty common and also pretty necessary. A good 77% of professionals today feel that personal activities have become a workday necessity, according to Captivate's Office Pulse News survey. Those elevator and lobby displays you see in big office buildings, that's what Captivate does. If your policy is to discourage workers from doing this route, here are a few reasons why you may want to rethink it. One, they'll be less stressed. Stress can be a huge distraction for workers to contend with, and the more your employees feel they are falling behind on life's many tasks, the more anxious they are apt to be. By giving your staff some leeway to tend to personal matters at the office, you will remove one layer of stress and help them better to focus on the work they need to be doing for the bulk of the day. Two, they will be more flexible with you. These days, close to half of full-time United States workers spend 50 hours or more on the job. It's no wonder, then, that so many professionals need to tap into the workday to deal with personal matters. But remember, if you want your workers to be flexible by staying late at the office as needed or logging on during weekends to deal with emergencies, then you need to be willing to grant that same leeway. And that means letting employees tend to personal tasks during the day without repercussions. Keep in mind that certain items can only be dealt with during business hours. For example, scheduling doctor appointments cannot be done in the evenings when offices are closed. The more understanding you are about the need to incorporate personal tasks into the workday, the less pushback you will get when employees are asked to give up more of their limited free time for work purposes. Three, they will be less likely to abuse sick days. The purpose of granting workers sick days is to give them ample time to recover from illnesses and avoid spreading germs in the office. But if you are not willing to look the other way when employees use work time for personal matters, then your staff members might get into the habit of calling out sick when their personal to-do lists start growing out of control. Rather than run that risk, you're better off allowing employees to spend a little time dealing with personal matters during the day, all the while keeping up with their regular scheduled tasks. It's one thing for workers to spend hours each day dealing with non-job related matters, but if your employees do so within reason, there's no sense in giving them grief for it. If anything, making it clear that you condone a little personal time during the workday could be just the thing that keeps your employees happy and drives them to do the best job possible on a whole. And that was an article by Marie Backman. It's smart to allow personal tasks at work.
Here's an article by Michael Collins, Jason Lalji, Sarah Elbeshbishi, and David Jackson. The article is entitled Outrage, Calls to Action. Trump opens the door to background checks. Washington. President Donald Trump said Wednesday that he is talking with congressional leaders and considering tougher background checks for gun buyers as lawmakers coalesce around the idea of red flag laws after mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. I'm looking to do background checks, Trump said at the White House as he departed for Dayton, where he met Wednesday with shooting survivors and first responders. I think background checks are important. Trump, who also visited El Paso on Wednesday, said he senses there is a very strong appetite for background checks, though many lawmakers have mostly focused publicly on red flag laws aimed at keeping guns out of the hands of people deemed an imminent danger to themselves or others. Trump indicated there wasn't a political appetite for banning assault weapons or large capacity magazines. Last weekend's shootings, which killed at least 31 people, may have opened the door, if only a crack, to the possibility that Congress could pass the most significant gun control legislation in more than two decades. Republicans who have staunchly resisted measures to tighten restrictions on guns have begun embracing the idea of red flag laws. There are some laws that I think bridge this issue of the guns and the mental health issue, and I think red flag laws is one, Senator Rob Portman, Republican, Ohio, said. Congress has consistently rejected attempts to tighten gun control regulations in the aftermath of other mass shootings. President Barack Obama angrily wiped away tears and urged Americans to demand that Congress stand up to the gun lobby's lies and protect citizens from gun violence after 20 first graders and six adults were killed in a 2012 shooting at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. Congress did nothing. Cries for tougher gun control measures were met with congressional inaction after mass shootings at a South Carolina church, a Pittsburgh synagogue, a Florida gay nightclub, a Maryland community newspaper, a Florida high school, a Las Vegas country music festival, and a Washington, D.C. Navy Yard. The last significant gun control measure to win congressional approval was an assault weapons ban enacted in 1994. The ban expired a decade later, and lawmakers did nothing to renew it. Trump said that in light of last weekend's shooting, he intends to persuade Congress to do things they don't want to do. Senator Pat Toomey, Republican, Pennsylvania, who has pushed Congress for years to pass tougher background checks for gun buyers, said he talked to Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, Kentucky, this week about the need for tougher gun laws. The truth is, there is no law that we can pass that guarantees that there will never be another such mass shooting, Toomey said. However, there are things that we can do to make our communities safer than they are today, and it's past time for Congress to act. McConnell, who has faced a torrent of criticism for blocking gun control legislation that passed the House by wide margins in February, said he has asked the chairman of three Senate committees to begin a bipartisan discussion about how to protect communities from gun violence without infringing on Americans' constitutional rights. McConnell gave no indication that he's willing to move ahead on the House background check legislation. For now, red flag measures appear to have the best chance of winning the bipartisan support to move through Congress. Two senators, Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Democrat Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, said they struck an agreement on the framework for legislation that would provide grants and incentives to enable gun law enforcement and courts to remove guns when there's a risk of danger to a gun owner or others. The lawmakers will be finalizing details of the bill and reaching out to their colleagues for support in the coming days and weeks, Blumenthal said in a statement. In the House, meanwhile, Representative Mike Turner, Republican, Ohio, whose daughter was in a bar across the street when the shooting started in Dayton on Saturday night, issued a statement Tuesday announcing his support for preventing military-style weapon sales to civilians, magazine limits, and red flag legislation. This article, entitled Outrage Calls to Action, was written by Michael Collins, Jason Lalji, Sarah L. Beshbishi, and David Jackson.
And the Sun Sounds of Arizona time is 6:27. Our next article is by Ryan Miller and is entitled False Alarms Spread Fear Even at This Newspaper. The panic spread quickly in Times Square. A loud bang, then people scattering in all directions. What many thought would be another tragedy in a sea of mass shootings turned out to be another false alarm. A motorcycle had backfired, sounding like the gunshot of an active shooter. After a week-long string of mass shootings, multiple false reports and hoaxes of active shooters have spread around the country, highlighting an acute fear many Americans feel in the wake of the incidents. This is a real phenomenon, said Arthur Evans, CEO of American Psychological Association. We do not have to go through these events directly. Simply hearing about them can affect us in ways similar to those who directly experience the incident. According to a survey by the Chapman University in 2018, more than 4 in 10 Americans fear mass shootings. In Dayton, Ohio, a gunman killed 9 people outside nightclubs early Sunday. In El Paso, Texas, a shooter killed 22 at a Walmart on Saturday. And in Gilroy, California, a week before, a gunman killed 3 people at an annual food festival. According to the not-for-profit Gun Violence Archive, there have been 253 mass shootings in 2019 as of Wednesday. The archive categorizes mass shooting as incidents in which 4 or more people are shot or killed, not including the shooter. Times Square is safe and secure, but the panic and fear people felt tonight was all too real, New York Mayor and Democratic presidential candidate Bill de Blasio tweeted after the backfire scare. Nobody should have to live in constant fear of gun violence. Nobody, he said. It wasn't the only false alarm. Wednesday, USA Today's headquarters at McLean, Virginia, were evacuated after reports of a person with a gun. Employees filed out of their offices and gathered outside, wondering whether the reports were true, as heavily armed SWAT officers quickly entered the building and cleared each floor. Law enforcement response was heavy and thorough. Many gathered at buildings nearby and waited for an all clear from authorities. Hours later, police said the reports were unsubstantiated and found no one with a weapon on the grounds. "This is a non-event," said Fairfax County Police Chief Edward Rossler, Jr. "Everyone is safe, and I do not have any evidence that a crime was committed." Around the same time as the New York Panic Tuesday, a similar fear spread in a mall in Utah. A sign at the Valley Fair Mall in West Valley City fell, causing a loud noise that prompted someone to shout shots, KSL-TV reported. Video from the scene showed the crowd fleeing and shouting, unaware that there were no immediate dangers. The mall was evacuated. A Walmart in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was also the site of a scare after two men pulled weapons on each other Tuesday. No shooting occurred, East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff Sid Gautreaux said, but people ran when they said they heard pops they thought were shots. When shootings occur close to home or in a place where we often go, such as malls, the stress and fear associated with them can increase, Evans said. Many of these events are not happening in far-off places, he said. They are happening in places where people can see themselves. And that was an article by Ryan Miller. Americans jarred by backfires and evacuations.
And here's news in brief. Israeli woman convicted in $145 million scheme to defraud investors. An Israeli woman was convicted Wednesday of orchestrating a scheme to defraud tens of thousands of investors across the globe out of tens of millions of dollars. Lee Albaz, 38, is scheduled to be sentenced December 9th by a federal judge in Maryland following her conviction on three counts of wire fraud and one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud, according to Justice Department spokesman Peter Carr. Each count carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison. Elbaz was CEO of Yukon Communications, an Israel-based company that operated in the binary options industry under the brand names Binary Book and Big Option. Elbaz trained employees to lie to investors and rigged the odds against them, making and recouping any money, Justice Department Prosecutor Rush Atkinson said during the trial's closing arguments last week. Elbaz is one of 15 defendants in the case and was the first to be tried. Long-term California GOP stronghold now has more Democrats. A Southern California county between Los Angeles and San Diego, long known as a GOP stronghold, now has more registered Democrats than Republicans. Orange County's Registrar of Voters reported Wednesday there are 89 more Democrats than Republicans among its 1.6 million registered voters. The parties each have about 547,000 registered voters, while 441,000 registered voters have no party affiliation. It's the first time Democrats have outnumbered Republicans in Orange County in more than four decades, said Neil Kelly, the county's registrar of voters. The coastal county was home to President Richard Nixon. Ex-MSU dean with oversight of Nassar gets 1 year in jail. A former Michigan State University dean with oversight of now-imprisoned sports doctor Larry Nassar was ordered Wednesday to serve a year in jail after being convicted of neglect of duty and misconduct in office that stemmed from claims he sexually harassed students. William Strample learned his fate during a hearing in a Lansing courtroom nearly 2 months after the College of Osteopathic Medicine's ex-dean was convicted of those charges. He was acquitted of the more serious criminal sexual conduct charge. Strample, 71, faced up to 5 years in prison on the felony misconduct conviction, resulting from accusations he used his public office to sexually harass, demean, and proposition students who met with him to discuss academic issues. He also was convicted of willfully neglecting a duty to monitor Nassar. Mom, man face murder charge after girl 13 dies in hot car. Authorities say the mother of a 13-year-old girl and a man living with her are charged with murder after intentionally leaving the disabled child inside a hot car for 5 hours. A Colleton County Sheriff's Office report said Rita Pangalangan and Larry King checked on the girl twice Monday before discovering the doors were locked around 3 p.m. and then went for spare keys. They said she was dead by the time they got the doors unlocked around 4:15. The couple were denied bond. UN official says over 100,000 detained missing in Syria. Reports suggest that more than 100,000 people in Syria have been detained, been abducted, or gone missing during the country's 8-year civil war, with the government mainly responsible, the UN political chief said Wednesday. Rosemary DiCarlo urged all parties to heed the Security Council's call for the release of those arbitrarily detained and to provide information to families about them as required by international law. She said the UN can't verify the figure because it has been unable to gain access to detainees. DiCarlo also repeated UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' call for the Syria conflict to be referred to the International Criminal Court.
And the Sun Sounds of Arizona time is coming up on to 6:38. Our next article is by Claire Ulmer and Katie Aiken and is entitled State Fair Soapbox is Iowa Tradition in White House Race. 20 minutes. A microphone, lots and lots of Iowans, and the eyes of the nation. That's what greets political hopefuls who take the stage at the Des Moines Register Political Soapbox. This year, the soapbox at the Iowa State Fair will host more than 20 presidential candidates, both Democratic and Republican, as they vie for the nation's highest office. Dwight Eisenhower in 1954 was the first presidential candidate to campaign at the state fair, and presidential candidates have flocked to the fair amid agriculture competitions and fried foods ever since. In 2007, Barack Obama drove the fair's bumper cars with his then 6-year-old daughter, Sasha. In 2011, on the Register's soapbox, Mitt Romney said corporations are people. 4 years ago, presidential hopeful Donald Trump did not appear on the soapbox but gave helicopter rides to kids near the fair. The fair allows candidates to don cowboy boots and eat giant turkey legs in the hot August sun. The soapbox provides a space for real political discussion. Face to face with Iowans, candidates might explain and defend their policy positions in front of the live audience. The Des Moines Register will live stream all of the speeches at DesMoinesRegister.com/soapbox. Dates are subject to change, and speakers may be added. The following Democratic candidates will speak Thursday: Steve Bullock and Joe Biden. Friday will be Julian Castro, Andrew Yang, John Delaney, Marianne Williamson, and Tulsi Gabbard. Saturday, the speakers will be Jay Inslee, Kamala Harris, Tim Ryan, Amy Klobuchar, Joe Sestak, Kirsten Gillibrand, John Hickenlooper, Elizabeth Warren, and Cory Booker. Sunday, Tom Steyer, Michael Bennett, and Bernie Sanders will be there. Pete Buttigieg will appear Tuesday, followed by Seth Moulton on August 17th. Republican Bill Weld will take to the soapbox Sunday. Democrat Wayne Messam and Trump have been invited to the Des Moines Register's political soapbox, but have yet to schedule appearances. Beto O'Rourke canceled his appearance after the mass shooting in El Paso, Texas, where he lives. And that was an article by Claire Ulmer and Katie Aiken. State Fair Soapbox is Iowa Tradition in White House Race.
And here's the opinion column. Today's debate, cybersecurity. Our view, hacker picks pockets of Capital One customers. Once upon a time, any financial institution entrusted with your money and sensitive information could be housed in an imposing building made of granite. Its vault, often visible from the lobby, was formidable, and its managers would always be prudent, conservative types. The idea was to convey a sense of security so that people would feel good about depositing their hard-earned cash and storing their prized possessions in a safe deposit box. It spilled over to investors who saw bank stocks as prudent, though hardly spectacular, investments. Now, though, banks can't do enough to shed the dowdy images, perhaps none more so than Virginia-based Capital One Financial Corporation. During an earnings report this year, CEO Richard Fairbank all but said that he did not view his bank as, well, a bank. What we're doing at Capital One is building a technology company that does banking instead of a bank that just uses technology, he noted. Which brings us to the company's announcement that a lone hacker, allegedly a troubled 33-year-old woman in Seattle, had managed to penetrate its firewall to acquire sensitive data on more than 100 million card customers and applicants. The sad truth is that many modern banks don't much care about people's private data. The same apparently goes for companies that work with banks. On the same day the Capital One breach was reported, credit rating agency Equifax agreed to pay $700 million to settle a 2017 breach. Institutions might say they do care, but what really matters is how fast they can digitize everything about their company and migrate it to the cloud. By doing this, they increase their profit margins and rates of growth and become Wall Street darlings. Tech companies, however, are bad examples to follow. They collect data on people's habits that allow advertisers, political operatives, hostile foreign powers, and others to glean valuable insights. And banks hold even more sensitive information than do most tech outfits. It's one thing to be lax and self-interested with people's web surfing histories or social media contacts. It's quite another to be cavalier with account information, social security numbers, and credit scores. These can be sold to people interested in taking out fraudulent loans, making fraudulent purchases, and engaging in other forms of identity theft. For this reason, banks can't become tech companies. They need to retain their positions as fortresses of people's wealth and vital data. outsourcing information to cloud computing companies like Amazon Web Services, in Capital One's case, has to be rethought. Capital One's catchy marketing slogan, "What's in your wallet?" has helped make it one of the nation's largest issuer of credit cards. If it doesn't change its ways, the answer to its question will be not very much.
And the opposing view is by David Murphy, who is a senior technology editor at Life Hacker. Capital One did not respond to requests for an opposing view. And the other view is use technology to protect customers' data. I do not care how a bank acts, whether it wants to be a bank, a technology company, or a circus. I am a happy customer as long as it secures my data. Unfortunately, Capital One's recent data breach shows the risks of adopting a move fast and break things mentality in the financial world. I was not one of the more than 100 million affected by Capital One's misfortune last week. Even if I were, I would still prefer that the bank continue to embrace technology if it can focus on the right things. That means hiring a director of cloud security more than a mere 2 months ago and dedicating even more resources to proactive information security and risk management, ensuring that vulnerabilities are found and fixed before the customers get hit. A bank performs threat analysis for its brick and mortar branches. Its cybersecurity should be subject to the same rigorous, never-ending scrutiny. Penetration testers and white hat enthusiasts should be Capital One's best friends, but having a generous bug bounty program would not hurt either. I bet it would cost Capital One a lot less than a class action settlement. Going forward, Capital One needs to double down on technology, not get cold feet. As a customer, I should have a text message, a phone notification, and an email the minute the bank uncovers a major security issue. I should have even more notifications if I find my data is in a breach, and its app should immediately prompt me to change my account password the second I log in. There should also be an easy way to activate free credit monitoring at any of the big three bureaus, and I should be prompted to set up device notifications for any changes or transfers made on any of my accounts, just in case. Rise to the same security standards and usability customers expect from their backup software or encrypted messaging apps. The time for tiptoeing on the technological tightrope has passed.
Millions in coins grabbed from Mexico's mint. This article by Adriana Rodriguez. Gunmen raided Mexico's federal mint headquarters in Mexico City and looted valuable items from a vault Tuesday, including gold coins that were worth millions of dollars, authorities said. City Public Security Secretary Jesus Horta Martinez told news station Telediario that three armed men disarmed security guards at the offices and went straight to the vault, which was open. The official said the gunmen got away with gold coins, commemorative watches, and other valuables. He didn't put a value on the loss, but local media said the stolen items were worth up to 50 million pesos, or $2.5 million. The value of the haul could be even greater, Reuters reported. One of the robbers was able to fill his backpack with approximately 1,567 gold coins after breaking into the Casa de Moneda branch. According to the Mexican bank Banorte, the coins have a face value of 50 pesos, but trade for about 37,000 pesos apiece, which translate to more than $1,800 each. A statement by Mexico City Secretariat of Public Securities said that security protocols weren't followed at the time of the incident, and investigators have taken in staff and security for questions, according to CNN. This article by Adriana Rodriguez is entitled Millions in Coins Grabbed from Mexico's Mint.
And the Sun Sounds of Arizona time is 6:50. Our next article is by Joshua Boat. Texas police apologize for leading man on rope. A Texas police chief says two white officers on horseback used poor judgment when they led a black man by rope to a mounted patrol staging area on Saturday, an incident that prompted viral outrage on social media as photos circulated. Galveston Police Chief Vernon Hale said in an apology that the department has changed its policy on technique, which is sometimes used for crowd control after the arrest of Donald Neely, 43. Neely was arrested for criminal trespassing, according to a statement from Galveston Police. He was handcuffed and a line was attached to the cuffs because the transportation unit was not available. Critics say the image shows a demeaning treatment of a black man, drawing on a history of slavery and violence historically displayed toward black people in the United States. It is hard to understand why these officers felt this young man required a leash as he was handcuffed and walking between two mounted officers, said Adrienne Bell, a candidate for Texas Senate, in a Facebook post Sunday. It is a scene that has invoked anger, disgust, and questions from the community. The two officers were identified as P. Brosh and A. Smith in the statement. Representatives for the Galveston Police Department did not immediately respond to requests for comment by USA Today. That was an article by Joshua Boat. Texas police apologize for leading man on rope.
And here's news from across the 50 states. Morton, Mississippi. U.S. immigration officials raided several food processing plants in the state Wednesday, part of a large-scale operation by President Donald Trump's administration. The raids came hours before Trump visited El Paso, Texas, to offer sympathy to the majority Latino border city, where a man linked to an online screed about a Hispanic invasion was charged in a shooting that left 22 people dead. Workers filled three buses at a Koch Foods Incorporated plant in Tiny Morton as about 70 family, friends, and residents waved goodbye and shouted, "Let them go, let them go." Later, two more buses arrived.
From Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, park officials have confirmed that a lightning strike sparked a fire that destroyed the historic Mount Holmes Fire Lookout Tower during a severe thunderstorm last month.
Montgomery, Alabama. A new local bookshop and community space called 1977 Books plans to open downtown next month, featuring poetry, memoirs, and children's books, with an emphasis on authors who are queer, transgender, indigenous, or of color.
From Fort Monroe, Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam is praising the removal of Confederate President Jefferson Davis's name from an archway at the site where the first enslaved Africans arrived in Virginia 400 years ago.
Fairbanks, Alaska. A group of advocates is petitioning for an end to wolf hunting in a national park boundary area. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports the group is concerned about a decrease in the number of wolf sightings in parts of Denali National Park.
From Concord, New Hampshire, to highlight the state's tax-free status, the Liquor Commission is offering out-of-state customers discounts at its liquor and wine outlet stores.
Phoenix, Arizona. Environmental groups have asked a judge to stop a plan to replace existing vehicle barriers along the U.S.-Mexico border. The groups argue the Trump administration unlawfully waived dozens of laws as part of the project that will ultimately damage wildlife habitat.
From Barnegat Township, New Jersey, Republican Mayor Alfonso Cirilli is urging residents to oppose a state law that requires middle and high schools to instruct students on the contributions of lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender people.
Little Rock, Arkansas. The state should have harsher penalties for those who commit crimes against others because of their race, ethnicity, or religion, Governor Asa Hutchinson says, and he wants to end Arkansas's distinction as one of only a handful of states without a hate crimes law.
And from New York, New York, the city's waters have welcomed a rare visitor, a beaver. The New York Times reports the animal was seen in the Hudson River on Monday. Beavers used to be plentiful in the area a few hundred years ago.
West Lafayette, Indiana. A second grader's plea to Mayor John Dennis has yielded a benefit for area reptiles with new turtle crossing signs printed and installed.
And that brings us to 657. And we'll take a short station break and be back with the rest of the USA Today at 7.
Way down here, you need a reason. Feel like a fool, running stateside games, lose your load. Leave your mind behind, maybe chase. Oh, Mexico. It sounds so simple, I just got to go. The sun's so hot, I've got to go home. I guess I'll have to go home now. Americana, got the sleepy